evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, April 20, 2018. South Sudan's Army Chief of Staff is dead.
General James Ejongo Maud was a remarkable man who was a committed founding member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. He served this nation with dedication and honor and shall be remembered as a hero.
And a senior former SPLA officer says South Sudan has lost a brave soldier.
With the presence of some of my gallant comrades like the late James Ejongo now we are talking about, Commander Paul Malong, Commander Pian Geng Kwal, Commander Elias Wayenjipoch, and were able to uproot the presence of Sudanese army garrison in Kogreal.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of South Sudan's army, General James Ejongo Maud, died this morning after a short illness. Government spokesman and Minister of Information Michael Makoi says General Ejongo died in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
It is with great sorrow and heavy heart that I announce the untimely death of General James Ejongo Maud, the Sudan People's Liberation Army Chief of Defense Forces.
Flanked by cabinet ministers and four SPLA deputies of the Chiefs of Defense, government spokesman Michael Makuei reads a statement to reporters from President Salva Kiir. Radio Tamazos reported on its website last week that General Ejongo traveled abroad for medical care of an undisclosed health problem. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwang was quoted by Radio Tamazos as saying Ejongo was also in South Africa in recent months for medical treatment. President Kiir offered his condolences to General Ejongo's family through a statement read by Makuei.
We join you in grief and pray that God's peace be with you all during this difficult moment.
Ejongo hails from the Luo community in northern Bahr el Ghazal. He joined the then rebel Sudan People's Liberation Army in 1984, shortly after it was formed by late Dr. John Garang de Mabior. He was among a group of South Sudanese students who abandoned their studies at Rumbek Senior Secondary School and took up arms to fight against the Sudan government. Upon attaining his military training within the then rebel SPLA, he was commissioned as second lieutenant in 1984 and was deployed as part of the Jamus Battalion, where he rose through the ranks, serving in the Equatoria and Bahr el Ghazal regions. In May last year, Ejongo replaced the Army Chief of Staff, General Paul Malong, who was fired by President Kiir. Makuei describes Ejongo as an honest, hard-working soldier, one who will be accorded a full state funeral befitting his stature.
General James Ejongo Maud was a remarkable man who was a committed founding member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army. He served this nation with dedication and honor and shall be remembered as a hero.
The government announced 3 days of mourning for Ejongo, with the flags being flown at half-mast across the country in his honor. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudan's former Deputy Minister of Defense says South Sudan has lost a humble and brilliant military officer. Majak Dagot says the late General James Ejongo was one of the successful leaders in the South Sudan Army. Dagot says Ejongo's death leaves a big gap in South Sudan Army.
Who has served the interests of his people tirelessly and with all his efforts. Commander James Ejongo Maud, as we used to call ourselves during the days of the liberation struggle, is such a strong character, humble, and a caring leader. He used to be loved by his subordinates. He worked under my command in Bahr el Ghazal when I was the commander of the SPLA Third Front, and we participated in a number of combat operations where he played a very important role for various successes that we achieved then. And when I came to serve in the Ministry of Defense between 2011 and 2013, Comrade James Ojonga Mahut was one of the top leaders of the SPLA at the time. He worked in full cooperation with his colleagues, his superiors, and his subordinates to help, like the rest of us, to transform the SPLA into a professional military.
Let's talk a little bit about his tenure in office. I mean, he was appointed in May. Comparing him to the previous chief of staff, the first chief of staff was Oya Edenga Jack, and then you have James Otmai, followed by Paul Malong. How would you really rate his performance in the SPLM? I mean, we're not talking about success or failure, but that contribution he has given to the country during this short time that he was there in the office.
Well, his tenure was quite short, and he came to the leadership of the SPLA at a very difficult juncture in our history. General Ojonga was well gifted and he was talented and could have turned things around under normal circumstances. The fact that he inherited the SPLA leadership when the country was divided and the country was at war with itself, the best of General Ojonga could not come out. The best of the service that he could have rendered the country could not come out because of this constraint.
You had worked with him in Northern Bahr al-Ghazal during the time of war against Sudan government. Is there any moment that you and the late General James Ojonga sat together and shared and laughed together? Is there any happy moment that you have had together that you want to share with us at this point as the nation celebrates his life?
There are so many occasions that our paths crossed with Comrade Commander General James Ojonga when we were part of the liberation struggle. The most spectacular moment that I would still remember was when we organized the attack to capture Gogreal. Gogreal was one of the fortified garrisons in South Sudan. It was a very difficult military objective. But with the presence of some of my gallant comrades like the late James Ojonga now we are talking about, Commander Paul Malong, Commander Pien Benkwal, Commander Elias Wayenjikoch, all of us put our efforts together and were able to uproot the presence of Sudanese army garrisons in Gogreal. James Ojonga, like other gallant officers, such as Mangar Bong, Mariel Chen Wong, and so many of them, played a very critical role in achieving those military objectives. I was together with James Ojonga in Gogreal. I was together with him around a log bridge between Awil and Wau. And all of us worked together in clearing garrisons along the railway in Northern Bahr al-Ghazal at the time. So this is an officer who has contributed a lot. And take it that South Sudan has lost a great treasure.
That's Majak Dagot, South Sudan's former Deputy Minister of Defense, who is now a member of the SPLM former detainees. He was speaking to me earlier today from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. SPLA rebels loyal to former first vice president Riek Machar claim they killed 11 government soldiers and lost one of their own in two clashes about 20 kilometers west of Juba and the other in northern part of the country on Wednesday. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Like many other clashes, both sides accuse each other of starting Thursday's fighting on the outskirts of Juba. South Sudan Army's spokesman, Brigadier General Lul Rai Kong, says a convoy of government vehicles carrying supplies to soldiers in Amadi State came under heavy attack from SPLA-IO rebels.
The convoy was carrying food and medical supplies as well as salaries for our soldiers deployed there. On reaching the outskirts of Juba, it fell in a rebel ambush between Juba and Luri. Our forces fought back in self-defense, and they dislodged the rebels and managed to break through. That was what had happened yesterday.
Kong could not say how many government soldiers were killed, since casualty figures are still being verified by the commanders. SPLA-IO deputy spokesman Colonel Lampol Gabriel says his side inflicted heavy casualties on the government soldiers during the fighting.
We lost one person from Baghdad. We sustained 4 injuries, which are minor. They are currently for treatment. But from the government side, we counted in Wunuliyye 2 dead bodies. Then in Baghdad, 9 dead bodies counted on the ground. Those are the ones found.
Gabriel accuses government forces of attacking a rebel base, which he says ignited the fighting.
They went to 2 of our bases in a place called Baghdad. That is on the side of Kuda. Then around Lurid, that is in a place called Wunuliyye. Wunuliyye is our base. If we attack them in Juba or around that area, we'll attack them in Lurid Barracks, where exactly the military is, or where the presidential guard is, or we'll attack them in Bilfam or Geada. So we did not attack first.
Kong insists the SPLA-IO forces started the fighting.
It is an indication that the rebels are not for peace, they are for war. And every step we take, even if we are still observing the cessation of hostilities agreement, we know that we have a very unfaithful partner, a partner that uses every opportunity to inflict harm on us.
Gabriel says it is the government that has violated the agreement with multiple attacks across the country.
They attacked us in Motot, they attacked us in Piri, then they also attacked us in a place called Patai. So these are the places where they all came and attacked. You know, the government do not want peace. We are here for peace.
Following the clashes in Luri, the United States Embassy in Juba issued a security alert on Thursday, informing U.S. citizens in Juba about the temporary change of U.S. Embassy curfew time from 8:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. until April 23rd. African Union and UN officials who visited South Sudan this week called on the warring parties to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement they signed late last year and work to restore peace. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese refugees return home after fleeing their countries for more than a decade ago. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What do you want people to remember you for?
I want them to remember me for how much I've impacted in their life, as when they needed me or providing help for them in so many ways.
I think more than anything, I want people to remember me for leaving a legacy. I want people to remember me as someone who was there for other people.
I want people to remember me as a honest person, an honest man, and a generous man. I like giving. The same way I like receiving, the same way I like to work hard. Yeah, I want people to remember me as a man who was too honest and generous.
I want to put up this thing for a girl child, whereby we have platforms to talk to different girls about our values and what we are capable of doing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The UN Refugee Agency reports a first group of 53 Sudanese refugees living in Chad has returned to the homes they fled in North Darfur more than one decade ago. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it hopes this first repatriation of Sudanese refugees will trigger the voluntary return of thousands more. The UNHCR says the security situation in Darfur has greatly improved since February 2003, when rebel groups in the region began fighting the government of Sudan. That war killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions, both inside Sudan and as refugees in neighboring countries. Conditions in Darfur since have dramatically improved. The group of 53 refugees who left the Iridimi camp in eastern Chad Saturday are among some 300,000 refugees from Darfur currently living in 12 UNHCR and government-run camps. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic tells VOA there has been a significant reduction in inter-ethnic tensions and displacement in Darfur. He says the agency has provided proof of that to the returning refugees.
It is important to understand that these people came first on a so-called go-and-see visit to see the conditions, to see what their homes look like and so on, before making that decision. There is a growing interest in the returns, and we do expect that there will be, as I said earlier, thousands of people returning in the course of this year.
Mahecic says the refugees are given transportation and a return package to help them restart their lives. He says the aid includes a 3-month supply of food rations provided by the World Food Program. He says the UNHCR and partners are working with the Sudanese government to improve services in North Darfur. He notes the importance of rehabilitating the depressed area to ensure returns are durable and sustainable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Cameroon, it has become more common to see official documents leaked on social media. The text of President Paul Biya's 2 most recent nationwide addresses were circulated before he even delivered them. Authorities are cracking down. For VOA, Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé that at least 16 government employees have been detained over alleged leaks since the start of the year.
In March, a confidential presidential memo began circulating on social media in Cameroon. It instructed security agencies to restrict travel for about 2 dozen senior state workers accused of stealing state funds. 3 police officers are now behind bars awaiting trial in connection with the leak. In April, another confidential presidential order surfaced online, this one increasing the allowances of soldiers deployed to the turbulent English-speaking regions. 2 defense ministry staffers were called up for questioning. Rights groups have long criticized Cameroon and other African governments for being overly opaque. Cameroon-born analyst Tem Fumbu is with the Open Society Initiative for West Africa based in Dakar.
It is part of a broader pattern of crackdown against any sort of dissent. It's not only about those who are leaking official information, but there's been systematic crackdown against all those who try to dissent in Cameroon. So it's a very alarming situation, and civic space in Cameroon has been closing very considerably in the last few years. And it's very concerning, especially given now that we're going into elections in 2018.
The response from African governments is often that transparency must take a back seat to stability. Cameroon is no exception. In March, Prime Minister Philemon Yang said the leaking of sensitive official documents threatens both the Biya administration and national security. His office declined VOA's request for an interview. Lawyers for state employees detained over alleged leaks declined to comment to VOA as the cases are ongoing. Here at a documentation center in Yaoundé, VOA found several government workers either printing or typing documents from their offices. They say they lacked the necessary computer equipment or had run short of ink. Information technology specialist Peter Suife said state workers need education on dealing with sensitive information electronically.
You have government offices that have computers. The operators of these computers don't know how to properly store some documents in their files. When they type, they take the key to a documentation for printing. After printing, they are supposed to cancel what they have printed in that documentation rather than allow it in the machine. Tomorrow you see the documents already on streets before the state ever make a statement.
The law in Cameroon says government employees must protect classified and confidential materials. Failure to do so could lead to dismissal as well as penalties ranging from a $10 or 5,000 CFA franc fine to as much as 1 year's imprisonment. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Libya says it has closed over half the detention centers for the thousands of refugees who have fled conflict in neighboring countries. Athumani Belbisi, the chief of mission in Libya for the International Organization for Migration, tells VOA's Paul Alexander that he hopes all detention centers can be closed.
So, talking about the humanitarian situation in the country in general, we believe that a lot of improvements need to happen, and the situation is not ideal at the moment. Talking about the political side, I'm purely talking about the humanitarian side.
What are the critical needs right now?
Unfortunately, the majority of the migrants in Libya are irregular, and they do not hold valid travel documents, which makes them also vulnerable, and there is a little proof about their nationality and also very limited opportunities for jobs in the country, given the current political and security challenges. With this situation, there needs to be a solution in different parts, I would say, or in different phases. At the short term, we need to try to address the needs, support people wherever they are, return those who want to go back home to return back to their home country and start a new life. But the majority would still want to stay in Libya, or the majority still are in Libya. So we need to support them wherever they are. And this will require a huge effort, not only from the international community, but also from the Libyan authorities. Knowing the legal status of those people, it is not very easy for any government to say, I am willing to regularize this large number of migrants in the country. But we are saying small initiatives can help, and also more support for either resettlement programs or return or job opportunities in Libya would be very important.
The government has said that the number of migrants held by authorities has dropped by 80% since last May, and that they have closed 20 of the 50 three migrant detention centers over that period. Is that a good sign that the numbers are dropping?
Yes. So in average, before what happened in the area of Sobrata in November last year, the average number in detention centers was between 4,000 to 6,000. There was a peak due to what happened in Sobrata, where a number of migrants were on the streets, and that's why they were transferred to detention centers, which raised the number to almost 20,000. So it wasn't the normal number that we expect to be in detention centers in Libya. It was just related to one incident for a specific period of time. And after that, the numbers reduced. Now the latest we received is slightly higher than 5,000, maybe 5,500 migrants in detention centers. Now the government so far has closed in the last few months about 24 detention centers in Libya. We see this as a positive development, but again, we continue calling for the closure of all detention centers and providing alternatives to detention. But until this happens, because this may also require legal framework, we would hope that we will be able to at least improve the living conditions and the standards installed in those centers, stop arbitrary detention, release of vulnerable cases, and definitely no detention for children.
What is the current situation with the human smuggling rings?
Our smugglers maybe are not anymore directly involved in the transportation business, but also there are many actors who join this business, as it's a very good economic opportunity. In addition, the risks associated with smuggling are not that high, I would say. That's why more action against the smugglers will drop the chance of new people joining those networks, because there will be more risks associated with this business.
So are the numbers of arrivals changing at all?
We don't have accurate figures about the number of arrivals to Libya, which we don't believe have dropped significantly in the last 6 months. But the number of arrivals to Europe has definitely dropped.
So are you getting the cooperation that you need?
The situation on the ground is challenging. You will always need more support, not only in terms of funding, but also in terms of advocacy that we try also with all the countries involved to make sure that there is better treatment in detention. But if you talk about an overcrowded detention center, no matter how much you try to improve, you need to make sure that those centers will not be overcrowded. You need to make sure that the management of the centers is capable to carry out the duties. The main issue in Libya will continue to be restoring security, peace, and definitely the economic development.
That was Othman Belbisi, the chief of mission in Libya for the International Organization for Migration. He was speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. For every man, woman, and child on Earth, there is roughly one ton of plastic trash. That's according to a recent study. Advocates say tackling such a huge problem can start with a tiny step. With Earth Day coming up this Sunday, they are asking people to skip the straw. VOA's Steve Baragona has more.
Nearly every drink comes with a plastic straw. But have you ever wondered where they all go? Straws are among the most common items found in litter cleanups around the world. The nonprofit Ocean Conservancy has been holding cleanups like these for more than 30 years. Sarah Kohler is with the group's Trash Free Seas program.
And over the 30 years, volunteers have collected over 10 million plastic straws and stirrers off of beaches and waterways and coastlines around the world.
The group says the ocean is strewn with 150 million metric tons of plastic trash of all kinds, clogging coastlines, ensnaring wildlife, and even littering land far from any human settlement. And each year, another 8 million tons wash in. The problem is expanding rapidly in the fast-growing coastal nations of Southeast Asia, says Bridget Croak with the Sustainable Investment Group Closed Loop Partners via Skype.
And it's, you know, for two primary reasons. One is that the infrastructure isn't there to get it somewhere else.
The systems to collect, sort, and recycle materials are lacking in much of the developing world. The other reason, she says, is the single-use plastic packaging that makes up much of the trash is basically worthless. Plastic bottles are the exception that proves the rule.
There are kind of informal economy of waste pickers that are collecting that because they find value in that material and they can sell that.
Closed Loop Partners is working with some major companies to make more packaging recyclable and improve recycling systems. But in the meantime, Kohler and the Ocean Conservancy have a suggestion. Skip the straw.
For most of us, we can drink our beverage without a straw just fine. So it just kind of seemed like a really nice item to target to reduce the number that are out in the waste stream and effectively reducing the number that can end up on the beach.
Or try an alternative, like reusable, washable metal straws. While skipping the straw will not solve the plastic pollution problem, Kohler says it's a way people can get started.
We get questions all the time asking about how, you know, how people can prevent marine debris in their everyday lives. Skipping the straw is kind of the first thing that we tell them. It is really that entry point.
They hope people will then start thinking about other ways they can use less plastic and help keep it out of the oceans. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Friday, when I leave you with the song You Are Not Alone by Michael Jackson.
Another day has gone, I'm still all alone. How could this be? You're not here with me. You never said goodbye. Someone tell me why. Did you have to go?
We've been listening to Michael Jackson with the song You Are Not Alone. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your vehicles and homes. Share with us what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Have a safe and peaceful weekend. Please join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Just the